Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Frank Gerjevic, the editorial page editor of the Anchorage Daily News. Former Senator Ben Stevens will not be prosecuted. The federal officials have dropped their investigation of Stevens. There will be no further case. Paul, the investigation of Ben Stevens, former Senator Ted Stevens' son, has dragged on for most of a decade. Tell us about the latest development and give us some perspective on the length of this investigation.
Well, I think as far as length goes, this is probably one of the longer investigations, certainly not the longest. There was a senator in, I think, Montana that virtually had the same thing happen to him. He was one of six legislators whose office was raided in 2006 by the FBI as part of a wide-ranging and far-reaching corruption investigation in the state of Alaska. The question was, he'd received payments from Vico of over $200,000, I think it was $243,000. And the question was, what did he do for that money? Was he a consultant, as he claimed, or was it a thinly veiled bribe? So I don't. Apparently, they couldn't answer that question at this point, or he would have an indictment. But he was never indicted. He's never been charged with anything. Oddly enough, the Vico chairman, Bill Allen, says he bribed him.
This was on the witness stand.
Under oath, his right hand man, Rick Smith, says he bribed him, and Pete Kott says he bribed him, but apparently, those three apparently don't take their word for anything, so he's free and clear at this point.
Although you would agree it's one thing to say something, it's another to prove
it. It's not what you know, it's what you can prove, that's right.
Okay, Frank Gerjevic, how does the Ben Stevens story fit into the overall story of legislative corruption that's been going on more than 5 years, as Paul just reminded us?
Well, two ways, I think. One, as Paul said, he was he was one of the lawmakers who's was part of the blow up in August of 2006. This investigation had been going on for some time before that, but that's when everything became public. And they looked at they were looking for files having to do with Vico, and then also for some fisheries board payments that had been connected to legislation that had been the work of his father. So he was a major part of that. Certainly, if you look at the years that followed, probably the second biggest name involved in the whole thing, his dad, his late father being the biggest name. And then the second way I think he was involved was the fact that so much of this sort of went south because of federal prosecutorial misconduct, basically.
Especially involving his father.
Yeah, his father's case was simply dismissed by the Justice Department. They said, this is gone. This is so tainted, it's over with. And I think that given what's happened in the cases of, Wyrock, Kott, that you mentioned, Paul Coring, Vic Coring, all three of those former members of the State House, the feds are at the point where unless they had a case dead to rights, they're not going to pursue it.
Okay, Frank, what kind of impression did Stevens, Ben Stevens, make as a legislator? In your experience and from talking to people?
Well, he certainly had a meteoric rise. He was appointed to office by Tony Knowles in 2001. He won election in his own right, unopposed, in 2002. He quickly became majority leader under Gene Terrio, and then eventually, I think after 2004, when they organized, became the Senate president. He was described by, I think, various people as competent, pretty hard-nosed, cocksure of himself, competitive, something of a reputation of a bully. If he could intimidate you, he would, but not without a sense of humor. Described by one Senate Democrat, I think, as somebody who knew his numbers, gave the impression of a man who knew what he was doing and knew what he wanted. I think he had one famous brush-up with Gene Terrio over the identity theft bill, and this was described by a couple different people as probably the most blatant attempt at calling a circle a square that anybody ever tried in the legislature.
With that run-up, you must tell us.
This was, if I have this right, an identity theft bill had been passed, I think overwhelmingly, maybe unanimously in the House. For some reason, Stevens did not want it to go any further. And so the bill is sitting there with the secretary, and Gene Theriau stands up and tells the Senate president that the bill's there, and Ben Stevens says the bill's not here. And Theriau maintains the soft-spoken, Mr. President, I think if you look, you'll find it. And Stevens, hard-nosed, won't relent. It's not here, not here. Well, what was striking about this, too, is that not only did everybody in the Senate know it was there, so you've got somebody just telling everybody, essentially lying to them about it, was the fact that the Senate then did something that was out of the ordinary. They basically rolled the Senate president and voted, I think it was 13-7, to spring it out from the secretary's desk, whereupon, if I remember right, Stevens then killed it by assigning it to three committees. And this is the end of the session. But what was, it was sort of a case of you saw the intimidation factor there. And in that case, you had Theriau just wouldn't relent, and Stevens had to give it up.
I'm going to add a few words here with my experience with Ben Stevens. It was clear he was very bright, and he shared that with his father. What was striking to me is the way he would go out of his way to make clear to the press that he didn't want anything to do with them, he didn't respect them, and wasn't interested in what they thought or what they did. It's the only time I've ever gone into a legislator's office to make a sort of courtesy call, establish some kind of acquaintanceship, and have a senator pretend that I didn't even exist. I got the message and left, if that's the message that was being sent. And this is in contrast to people who, we investigated Jerry Ward, for example. And Jerry Ward would always be personable with you and come up and tell jokes and tell stories. And you don't have to do that, but this was striking, was the contrast between what his clear ability was, and he wasn't down there reading How to Win Friends and Influence People. Okay, Governor, I'm back again with Michael Carey. I'm here with Frank Gurdjieff and Paul Jenkins. Paul Jenkins. Governor Sean Parnell clarifies Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell's role in state government. Paul, this is very unusual. In fact, I never heard of anything like this.
I think most lieutenant governors in states across the country on election day vanish. They show up here and there, and then eventually the next election, nope, there they are again. And they're expected to stay out of trouble and not make headlines and make the boss look good. In this case, we have a guy that's really well-versed in Arctic policy issues, any kind of Arctic issues. And I think he was using his position to go into various departments of the state. This is the charge, anyway, that he was sidestepping commissioners and department heads and going into their underlings and saying, look, give me a hand here with this, do that. And it was causing, I think the governor said it was causing confusion and consternation. So he had apparently earlier on asked him, let's not be doing that. And it apparently continued, or so the charge is. And the governor then sent a letter to him, I guess, which was...
Didn't he send it to 12 or 14 people?
He sent it to enough people where it's guaranteed to get out in public. And so it did, rather than going down to his office and say, look, let's have a beer. Let's don't be doing this.
They don't do that.
He gives him a nasty gram. That's the end of that. And the next thing you know, they're at odds. Now, today, it's kissy-kissy, we love each other, but nobody really knows what damage has been done. Treadwell, I think for his part, has pledged allegiance, and by golly, he's a team player. And he probably really is a team player. So I'm not sure where it'll go from here, but a nasty little dust-up. It was kind of interesting to watch.
Frank, you've known and seen many of the lieutenant governors in the state for the last, 30-something years? Close to it, anyway. How does this fit in? And give us some perspective on other lieutenant governors and their relationship with their bosses.
We've had certainly strained relations before. I think Lauren Lehman and Frank Murkowski, weren't holding hands by any means. But I think in the case of Meade Treadwell, it doesn't seem to me to be terribly out of line. We've had certainly lieutenant governors who had their own interests and pursuits. I don't think Fran Ulmer didn't exactly disappear when she was lieutenant governor under Tony Knowles. I think what you have here is maybe a case where the governor is feeling like, okay, you're stepping over the line. He couldn't have expected Meade Treadwell, given his background, you know, his, as Paul said, you know, just well-versed in Arctic issues, you know, with experience with the Institute of the North, with Wally Hickel. He comes from, he's been a successful businessman. He's not just going to sit there and, you know, politely nod every time, you know, the governor speaks up. He may or may not have his own ambitions, but I think, you know, he's a smart, capable man who just, you know, thinks the governor, the job should be more than, I think, Paul, you commented once about, you know, safeguarding the state seal and overseeing elections. So I think in some ways he's comparable to, you know, those who would, those lieutenant governors who had, you know, established careers and were, you know, sort of forces in their own right.
I think we should note that unlike in some states, the lieutenant governor here does not run in the primary paired with the governor. So the governor gets whoever arrives. Steve Cooper got Steve McAlpine, and they weren't exactly great friends. The other thing that does, there's some perhaps entertainment value in it, or it's certainly worth noting, is that when Jay Ramos ran against Treadwell, people who knew both these men said, oh boy, Parnell's going to be a lot happier if he gets Treadwell, because Ramos is sort of a loose cannon, and he ran on the premise of a new kind of lieutenant governor, and what do you know, Meade Treadwell turned out to be the new kind of lieutenant governor.
At least as far as the governor's concerned.
Yeah. Paul, unless you want to have a last word, we'll move on.
Go ahead.
Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar tours Alaska with Lisa Murkowski and Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island. Frank, what was the purpose of this visit?
Well, the secretary himself said there are three main purposes. The first was to focus on energy, particularly energy up north on the North Slope, both offshore and in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. He took flights over the area that Shell wants to drill in up there, and also over the MPRA, where ConocoPhillips wants to put a bridge over the Colville River. The other things he was looking at were relations with various Native leaders and groups as part of just the trust relationship that Interior has with them, and then also looking at the national parks. He stopped in Kodiak, where he, I think, did some work with both the Coast Guard and familiarizing himself with the salmon and how bears fish for them. And then he also visited Denali National Park, and I think he got to look at the site of a proposed new visitor center there.
And I imagine, as with most A-level guests, they weren't camping out in pup tents in the rain.
I don't think so. I don't know if they allow them to be rained on when they come up here like that. No, he covered a lot of ground, and I think this is his fourth trip up here. So he seems to be, you know, I think it's a becoming more and more familiar, and I think he has a pretty good sense of the, you know, the challenges up here.
Thank you, Frank. Paul, we like to tell important visitors that Alaska is unique, it's exceptional, we have exceptional challenges, and then we cite them and lay them out. But isn't it going to be true that every state is going to tell major visitors that? Rhode Island, perhaps, so Senator Reed's from, and can tell them it's one of the smallest states, one of the highest tax states, one of the oldest states. So how much does this exceptionalism argument work?
I don't know, but we really are exceptional. In case anybody's
facts
asking.
Facts, is that your argument?
There it is. I think up here, when he's up here looking at the oil industry, when he's looking at the Arctic and the oil industry, he's talking about the need for infrastructure and safe drilling. He's concerned that that Native Alaskans are included in the process. I think we're unique in that we have those things to offer. We are a national security interest up here. We can supply X percentage of oil to the nation. So we are exceptional in that respect. I think when he comes up here and pushes for better safeguards to ensure that we can drill more, I'm not sure that's a bad thing. I'm thinking in the long run that may be a good thing. But that, to me, we are unique. We're unique.
My experience with visitors is one of the things that shocks them is they get on a plane in Seattle or Minneapolis or wherever it is, and they find out how long it takes to get here and what they see, which is water, mountains, snow, trees, then all of a sudden,
nothing.
Anchorage, what's it doing there?
I think it's a matter of scale. I think it's important for visitors, especially congressmen and administration officials, to understand the scale in Alaska. When they start talking about, well, you know, the Tongass National Forest, well, geez, that's as big as some states, and it's monstrous. So does one shoe size fit all? No, and then they have to approach it that way.
Frank,
so we are
you are Paul, not Frank. Paul?
Well, I could.
And what about Salazar pledging that there would be more opportunities for drilling? You'll note on the little memo I sent you that I have a typo. We were discussing typos.
For
I said billing, but we're going to talk about drilling.
Yes, he pretty much is pushing the idea that Obama wants to drill everywhere but Anwar. That's essentially it. We want better safeguards. We want to include Native Alaskans, and we want to drill. We've formed a new agency to be sure that kind of thing is looked at seriously. We've put together a task force, he says, to make sure that permitting and getting ready to drill is easier for the companies. So, yeah, he's pushing the idea of more drilling up here. It remains to be seen if those permits are ever issued. Shell has got one permit that's conditional on other permits being issued. So we'll see where that goes, and that's for the Beaufort Sea. And they're also wanting to go into the Chukchi.
And nobody's immune from the possibility of lawsuits.
There you go.
Okay, fisherman and former Lisa Murkowski aide Arnie Fugelvog is arraigned in an Anchorage courtroom. Frank, give us an overview of the charges and tell us about Murkowski's response, which drew considerable attention from the Anchorage Daily News editorial page.
Mm-hmm. Well, Arnie Fugelvog is a fifth-generation fisherman. He'd served on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and he's been a fisheries aide for Senator Murkowski since 2006. What had happened here is that he was subject of an investigation by federal fisheries authorities, and between 2001 and 2006, he apparently had done some overfishing and falsifying of records. And on April 8th, he signed a plea agreement with the feds, basically admitting that he had done this. Afterwards, apparently, Senator Murkowski was not aware of that this plea agreement had been signed. Now, she had been told by her chief of staff that Fugelvog had said he was being investigated in either December or January, this past December or January, and said when this came out that basically, well, she said, I'm going to let justice run its course. Sometimes these things don't turn out to be anything. When this finally became public, she said that she had been told of it on June 29th, about 2.5 months after he'd signed the plea agreement, but kept him on the staff until the day before this was going to become public. So the question came up naturally, okay, why is this man still on your staff? Why didn't you know, for example, that he had signed this plea agreement on April 8th? And when you did find out, why was he allowed to stay for another month? I mean, the questions here were basically, one, if you're told that one of your staff is under investigation for federal offenses, fisheries offensive, and this is your fisheries aide, and this was once a finalist for the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service, you'd think the first thing a senator is going to do is call that person into the office and say, what's going on exactly, and what did you do? And that apparently didn't happen here. And you would think also that it would be made very clear to the aide that if there is any change in the status of this investigation or your status, I want to know, and I want to know right now. And if things start looking dicey, it may be wise for you to just take a leave, or, you know, as is often done in these cases, yes, there's the presumption of innocence, but this puts a cloud over my office. Maybe you should step aside until we get this resolved. In this case, none of that happened. And then later, of course, comes the question, once you knew about the plea agreement, the presumption of innocence becomes a technical matter at that point, because there is no innocence.
Haven't been sentenced
yet. It becomes a matter of, okay, when are they going to give you the sentence? This is serious. I mean, this is talking about 10 months in jail, $150,000 in payments and fines, and just, you know, the whole contrast of a man who's entrusted with fisheries policy, what somebody, I think, called the most important fisheries aide in Washington, on, you know, our senior senator's staff.
And particularly given her role in committee assignments.
Exactly. And at this point, you just have to say, what business did he have, you know, to continue on this way?
Paul, this is very unusual, again, by any standard. How did this happen?
I don't.
Or can we dope it together?
I don't know that it's clear what happened. If he entered a plea agreement on April 8th, in my mind, if it were me, he'd be on leave or suspension or gone. When you enter a plea agreement, you're not saying, gee whiz, I might have done something. You're saying you did it. It was either, I think, a case of non-communication or poor judgment. I mean, there's no...
Or conceivably,
unless her staff concealed from her the fact that this had happened. But I would think it would be incumbent upon him to tell her. Just, you know, just face to face, here's the deal. And apparently that didn't happen, or we don't know what happened. So at this point, it's just a big question mark.
Frank, I couldn't help noticing the number of times that when people talked about this, they brought up Lisa Murkowski's relationship with Bob Penny and the Kenai River property purchase, which didn't go through and raised a whole bunch of questions. And when I heard this, of course, if people don't like you, they'll hammer you any chance they get. But this, some of what I heard was from people who like Lisa Murkowski and were appreciative of her. Mm-hmm. But there's sort of a question here of has she missed some important things, and does she have a predilection to that?
Well, I think if when it comes to missing something, I think in two cases we can say she did. I mean, the Kenai land deal was the kind of sweetheart deal with somebody who's politically active and has been a supporter of yours that, you know, any political figure should say, this isn't going to happen. I mean, this should never, shouldn't have done this deal. And when there was the public response to it, you know, if I remember right, she just simply sold the land back. They didn't do the deal. In this case, it seems like the same sort of thing where you'd say, wait a minute, this is, this just doesn't work to have somebody who signed a plea agreement for this kind of, this kind of an offense to stay on the staff, to stay on the federal payroll. And if, as Paul said, there could have been some miscommunication here, and I think he's right too, in that when you, it's incumbent upon the aide to go ahead and let the boss know, here's what's happening, so I don't leave you hanging out here, especially having supported me and given me the benefit of the doubt, and that doesn't work. But I think, going back to the senator, I think this is a case where, there's that old line that is sometimes in law and sometimes just as part of the unwritten rule where you avoid both the conflict and the appearance of conflict. So you have to be aware of it.
Okay. I was going to add very briefly, I attended the arraignment in Judge Holland's courtroom this week. There were about a dozen people present, seven or eight reporters and four or five other people, several of them apparently fisheries bureaucrats. The most interesting developments to me were that Arnie was asked about his education. He said he has almost a master's degree, so he's an educated person. That wasn't the problem. And the other thing is that he signed an addendum that has not been made public and, in fact, is sealed to the plea bargain or plea agreement. And that almost certainly indicates that he is helping the federal government in an ongoing investigation of somebody else. So probably there is quite a bit more to this story. Paul, headline, Palin gets legal aid to fight lawsuit. What lawsuit is this, and why is our former governor in need of aid?
I doubt that she's really in need of aid, but we're going to give it to her anyway. She's, as governor, we have a citizen of Juneau who complained about tour buses around the governor's mansion. She took that apparently as an attack on her living in Juneau, even though everybody else had been attacking her for not living in Juneau. So the gentleman got angry, suing.
Chip Toma, who is universally referred to in the press as either activist or gadfly.
Yeah, I'm not saying anything. So he basically is suing for $100,000 in federal court. And because the accusation is she did this as governor, harassed him, denigrated him, made fun of him, I guess, and all kinds of terrible things. The state is offering her legal help. She's got her own private attorney. The state won't pay for that.
The argument being she was acting in her official
capacity.
She was
the governor at the time, yeah.
Frank, it does seem that there are any number of times when a official or former official, the question is, were they acting in their official capacity?
Yeah, that's the question here. I mean, you could make a case for the state getting involved if that's what it is, just on general principle, if she was acting in her official capacity. But you step back and you look at this, and it's just, I don't know, it's another chapter in the Palin story. I mean, we're talking about a complaint about bus tours and things being crowded and whether or not, you know, looking at the Bailey book, you know, and what Palin did with emails and harassment, and it just comes across as another chapter in the circus.
Yeah, and we're familiar with that. Yeah. We have just a few moments left. Paul Jenkins, the Alaska Permanent Fund faces extreme volatility, losing $1 billion in close to a day. What is to be done? And getting some of it back.
I think we put our spurs on and ride this puppy to the end. I don't know. We've got good management. That's been shown over the years. I think we were investing for the long term, like individuals do. I think we just hang on.
Mike Burns of the Permanent Fund was on National Public Radio talking to the whole country yesterday, explaining the Alaska Permanent Dividend Fund.
Permanent Dividend Fund.
He wouldn't say that, but that was an editorial comment, I will withdraw. Thank you very much for joining Frank Gerjevic, Paul Jenkins, and I here on Alaska Edition. We'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.